I'm very happy to have Adam Anderson joining us from Fermilab, Chicago, telling us about constraining axions with CNB polarization rotation data from SPT. Adam.
Yeah, okay, so I'm trying to share my screen. Hopefully you guys can all see that.
Good.
Okay, cool. So well, thanks for having me speak here. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. And I know if your schedules are anything like mine, you're probably spending maybe 20, 30 hours a week on Zoom calls. So thanks for spending one more hour to actually come listen to a Zoom seminar, which I know is can be a bit much sometimes. So I'm a CMB experimentalist. I'm working primarily on projects of the South Pole. So I want to tell you about one of those projects primarily today, SPT3G. And so what I'll do is first give you a little bit of motivation for why just generally we're interested in building more and yet more sensitive CMB experiments. Not just CMB, not just SPT3G, but also looking forward, Simons Observatory and CMBS4. Then I'll tell you a little bit about SPT3G itself, and in particular, a couple of our upcoming first results from the first year of data from this project. And at the end, say a little bit about a fun side project that I've been working on since the pandemic started and since I've been locked out of the lab. Using SPT3G data to search for a time-varying polarization rotation based on this effect that was proposed in this paper last year by Michael Federke, who I see is online. So we're very excited about this new idea. So just to get us all reoriented, I think most of you are familiar with this well-established cosmic timeline, the history of the universe that's well established now, that began in early times of the period of exponential expansion during inflation. As the universe expanded after that, it cooled and eventually cooled sufficiently much that free electrons and protons recombined to form neutral hydrogen around 400,000 years after the beginning, in a period called recombination. And when that happened, of course, the photons that were present in the plasma at the time were suddenly able to free stream. The universe changed from being opaque to transparent to light, and these photons were able to free stream throughout the subsequent history of the universe until we detect them today as the cosmic microwave background. And so what I like about this picture is that it shows you why the CMB is such a powerful probe of cosmology. When we measure the CMB, not only can we learn about the physics of and the state of the universe at recombination, but the state of the universe at recombination is also affected by the physics that's operating at very early times. Processes like inflation, the particle species content of the universe affects the structure of the universe at recombination. And we can learn about physics at very late times because CMB photons have their trajectories deflected by gravitational lensing due to large-scale structure. And you can actually learn something about that. So from just the CMB alone, we're able to learn about many different periods of physics, of history throughout the entire timeline of the universe. Okay, so ultimately we're interested in making maps of the CMB like this one. This is the CMB temperature anisotropy from Planck, which I'm sure you're all very familiar with. But of course, the CMB doesn't just have a temperature anisotropy, it's also polarized. And you can go out and measure that polarization, and future experiments will get increasingly more of their cosmological information from the precision measurement of the polarization anisotropy. So this CMB polarization is really just a straightforward consequence of how Thomson scattering operates in the presence of a quadrupole anisotropy that gives you a linear polarization. And you can understand that by just thinking about how an electron, thinking about an electron in a quadrupole anisotropy where the photons coming from one direction are a little bit hotter than the photons coming from the other direction. And the scattered light, which preferentially scatters in the orthogonal direction, will have a little more of the hot photon in one direction, giving you a linear, net linear polarization of the scattered light. And then there's this when you go out and measure these polarization fields on the sky, there's this canonical decomposition into the E modes and B modes, the divergence-like and the curl-like polarization patterns in the CMB, which is useful, of course, because E modes are sourced primarily by density perturbations, whereas the B modes, at least on large scales, can only be sourced by gravitational waves. And on slightly smaller scales can also be sourced by this conversion of E modes into B modes that happens due to gravitational lensing, which I'll say a little bit more about later on. So the state of the art then in the measurements of the power spectrum is shown here in both temperature and E and B polarization. And the main takeaway that you should make from this plot is that the temperature power spectrum is much, much better measured than the polarization ones. It's basically cosmic variance limited in its measurements out to most of the scales that are relevant for cosmology. And so future measurements are really only able to improve in the measurements of the polarization, the E modes, and especially the B mode polarization, which are not as well constrained simply because the amplitude of those polarization fluctuations are much smaller. So we could talk at great length about all of the things you can learn from better CMB measurements, but I just wanted to highlight kind of three motivating physics topics that are constrained by better polarization measurements. And the first of these, I'm sure many of you are familiar with, of course, is inflation, which produces this spectrum of B modes at degree angular scales on the sky. And the story here is that the inflation produces this background of gravitational waves that will persist through recombination and produces a spectrum that peaks at about 2 degree scales on the sky, whose amplitude is parameterized by the tensor to scalar ratio R, this unknown quantity. And of course, the interest of this is that inflation is really the only mechanism for producing primordial large-scale B modes. And of course, there is this additional mechanism whereby gravitational lensing can produce B modes by converting E modes into B modes. So you can see there's this spectrum shown in green here that is kind of like a scaled copy of the red E mode spectrum. It's because it's sourced by the E modes, but at a lower level. And at a certain point, for values of R sufficiently small, the competition, the confusion between these two becomes quite relevant in that the inflationary B modes start to drop below the lensing B modes, which highlights the importance of measuring both, which is a theme I'll return to later on when we're talking about SPT. Highlights the importance of measuring a wide range of angular scales on both low resolution experiments and high resolution ones. The next point I wanna highlight that we can learn more about from better CMB measurements is the neutrino masses, which ultimately affect all of the power spectra in kind of a correlated way, both E modes, B modes, and the temperature. So the story here is probably familiar to some of you based on the idea that the sum of the neutrino masses affects the growth of structure in the universe, basically because neutrinos don't cluster in the same way that the cold dark matter does. So it produces a relative suppression as you dial up the sum of the neutrino masses at small scales in the matter power spectrum. And so that means that in principle, you can set upper limits on the sum of the neutrino masses from measurements of the matter power spectrum. And that's interesting and from an experimental point of view, because we are also able to set lower limits on the sum of the neutrino masses from oscillation experiments. And so this provides some hope actually that future cosmological experiments should be able to measure the absolute mass scale of the neutrinos, the sum of the neutrino masses. But of course, the CMB isn't actually sensitive to the matter power spectrum directly. We're measuring photons from the surface of last scattering. And so the way we actually get a handle on the matter power spectrum is through the CMB lensing. So the trajectory of these CMB photons is distorted by the intervening large scale structure, giving rise to deflections that are typically of order 2 arc minutes over patches that are coherent on roughly two degree scales. And it's from those coherent deflections that you can reconstruct the projected gravitational potential between us and the CMB. And so in this way, the CMB effectively probes the matter power spectrum and therefore the neutrino masses. And so then the last piece of motivation that I just want to highlight is coming from the very small, primarily from the very small scale information in the CMB, which is light thermal relics. So the story here is light thermal relics, these are like any light particle that freezes out in the early universe and is left around just as a relic. And the story here is kind of interesting because any, of course, as you guys probably know, any light particle in thermal equilibrium will have some contribution to the relativistic energy density at very early times, which in cosmology you typically parameterize as this N-effective parameter. And the point here is that the correction, the addition to N-effective, call it delta N-effective, that a light relic can have has a minimum value and it corresponds to the temperature at which freeze out occurs. And the reason here is, of course, as after decoupling, the contribution to the relativistic energy density of the light relic is diluted relative to the active neutrinos, basically because the standard model particles dump all of their entropy into the thermal bath and not into the thermal relic that's decoupled. So as you go to higher freeze-out temperatures, you'll end up having a smaller correction, smaller contribution to N-effective. But because there are only so many standard model particles, essentially, that value of delta N-effective can only get so small. And so by having sufficiently stringent constraints on N-effective, you can effectively rule out large classes of thermal relics with different spin degrees of freedom. And we're actually starting to get into potentially interesting regions of parameter space with current and upcoming experiments. So SPT3G is forecast to have a constraint on delta, one sigma constraint on delta N effective, something like 0.1, about 2 times better than the Planck constraint. And CMBS4 and Simons Observatory will do yet better. So that was kind of some general motivation for why, just generically, more CMB experiments, lower noise, large scales, small scales are important and interesting. Now I want to talk a little bit about one of those, SPT3G, which I spent a lot of time building over the past few years and has been taking data for a couple of years. So this is the 10-meter South Pole Telescope, which is a collaboration of, depending on how you count members, anywhere from maybe 30 to 100 scientists and engineers, students, postdocs across many different universities and national labs as well. This is our most recent collaboration meeting from last summer before the pandemic made it impossible for us to all stand in the same picture. Not surprisingly, it's located at the South Pole, which is actually a really great place to do these kind of observations, which is why there have been this whole series of CMB experiments located there with names you might have heard before. So the Keck Array and now the Bicep Array are just a few hundred meters from South Pole Telescope. Bicep 2 and Bicep 3 are actually in the same building. They're attached to SPT. And all of this is located next to, or actually on top of, IceCube, which comprise this dark sector of the South Pole site, about a kilometer away from the South Pole station. And SPT is somewhat unique in that it has this relatively large 10-meter primary mirror, which is the largest of its kind for a dedicated CMB experiment. And that allows it to have really good angular resolution of something like 1 to 1.5 arc minutes, depending on observing frequency, to produce the highest resolution CMB maps to date. And part of the reason why South Pole is such an excellent site for these observations is that it's extremely dry, of course, which means there's very little water vapor in the atmosphere to obstruct the microwaves, to absorb microwaves. And what's more, it's dry because it's extremely cold, not because the relative humidity is low. And so that means that it's the observing conditions in the winter are consistently good because it's simply not warm enough for there to be a significant amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, which means that the conditions are somewhat, on average, better than Chile and consistently more stable than they are in Chile. And in part, that is also due to the fact that we have this six-month night and these kind of peculiar laminar wind flows, which are very different than the kind of meteorological conditions that exist elsewhere in the world. And finally, we have this 24/7 access to the same clean patches of sky, which allows us to do this relentless, so-called relentless observing, where we just observe the same part of the sky for most of the year. And one side benefit, which has become clear only in the past few months, is that Antarctica is also the only continent on Earth that is currently COVID-free. So basically, most observatories now are shut down. The Atacama experiments are shut down. But because no one has been in or out of Antarctica since the pandemic really got bad, we're still observing. And we have not had any downtime. And that will continue, actually, through the next year. So there's kind of we're doing a minimal changeover of winter overs for the next season. And the hope is to just continue observing in the same way. So we've been, our remoteness has been an unexpected benefit in this case. So just to give a little bit of context for what this angular resolution allows us to do, I'm showing here a portion of the sky, a small patch of the sky, 50 square degrees, as observed by the Planck satellite. And when SPT, so SPT Pole, which is a previous receiver, previous CMB camera on the telescope, observes the same patch of sky, it sees this. So you see that we have significantly better, seven times better, angular resolution, which allows us to start resolving point sources, things like active galactic nuclei, dusty star-forming galaxies, even potentially transient sources, and then these dark spots, which are galaxy clusters that leave their shadows via the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect in the CMB. And so, you know, we're also able to go to lower noise, albeit only on a patch of the sky, about a 5% of the sky rather than the full sky that Planck can see. So the history and data sets involved here go back about 13 or so years. So there was this progression of increasingly sensitive cameras, starting with SPT-TSZ that had about 1,000 detectors, followed by SPT-Pole, which took data for about 5 years, adding polarization sensitivity. And so what we've now done is built a much larger detector array, which these pictures are to scale. So you can see that it really is about almost twice the diameter. And as a result of that, and the fact that we designed this new pixel architecture that means each pixel is sensitive to three colors instead of one, we have 10 times the number of detectors now operating simultaneously in three frequency bands, which gives us significantly better sensitivity than preceding experiments. And you know, I could talk for a long time. I could bore you with these technical details, which I won't do. But I'll just say that, you know, it sounds easy to swap in one of these new arrays of detectors, but it's not like you just go bolt in this new, you know, carry down this thing and bolt it in. It really required a complete redesign of the whole everything on the telescope except the primary mirror. New secondary optics to feed a larger field of view, new detectors with this new three-color architecture, new readout electronics to handle more detectors, and a new software pipeline even to handle the 10 times greater data rate. So what are we doing now? And what is the data that we're gonna have to play with? So we're working on a survey that spans about 1,500 square degrees, which is shown in red here, which has total overlap with the BA, so BA stands for bicep array experiment, which I'll say a few words on later on. So that was by design. And so over the course of about a 5-year survey, we'll get to noise levels that are deeper than any of our existing experiments over a much larger patch of the sky. So 1500 square degrees instead of in the SVT pole survey, 100 to 500 square degrees, and also in the 3 frequency bands. I'll also say a little bit more too about this extended survey that we're doing, which will provide some additional constraints on, or better constraints, hopefully, on cosmological parameters, as well as detecting more galaxy clusters. So the overall status of the survey has actually been going very well. So this is just a summary, a snapshot of where things stood in 2019 over the course of the full 9 months that we observed this 1500 square degree field. So this is some work that a grad student at Chicago and I put together. So we achieved about 60% observing efficiency lifetime on the CMB, which is pretty good. We have some irreducible losses due to the fact we have to like do these cryogenic cycles and we have to take calibration observations regularly. But this is 60% we're happy with. We can't do significantly better. The instantaneous sensitivity or NET, noise equivalent temperature, so it's shown in the second panel. And this is very nice as well. We have extremely stable sensitivity at 90 and 150 gigahertz. And the stability isn't quite as good at 220 gigahertz. And that has to do with the fact that the atmospheric transmission is less there. But in any case, the 2019 data is nice in the sense that it's much deeper already than the 2018 data was. We had sort of a partial season in 2018, and so whereas 2019 was substantially better. The other key metric that we care a lot about in these CMB experiments is the low L noise, low frequency noise, which is basically a measure of how well how good your noise is for detecting large-scale fluctuations, like large-scale B modes on the sky. So we haven't actually started an analysis targeting degree-scale B modes, but we have done a bit of work assessing what our low-frequency or low-L noise level is. And preliminarily, things seem quite good. And I should say this is a little bit of a challenge with a large telescope like SPT compared with a small telescope like BICEP. And the reason being that in a smaller telescope, it's much easier to shield side lobes because you can just put a long baffle, a long absorptive baffle on the output or the front end of the telescope. Whereas you can't put a 10 meter baffle around SPT, for example. And so it's much, much harder to control pickup from side lobes in a large telescope, which means that it's more challenging to achieve good noise performance at these large angular scales. So the fact that we see very little increase in the noise level, which is shown, the polarized noise level, that's what's shown in the dashed lines here, the Q and U polarized noise level. The fact that this is basically flat down to below L of 100, suggests that we're doing quite well, and this is an improvement over previous iterations in the receiver. Basically, because we eliminated issues with electronics that were causing low frequency noise. So I think it's we're still working on assessing this, and this is the performance at 90 gigahertz, which isn't as good as 150, 220. But I think it's fair to say that we're very encouraged by the performance that we've achieved so far at 90 gigahertz. So the other survey that we're working on recently is this so-called SPT-3G extended survey, which takes advantage of a defect, really, or exploits a problem that we have with our survey strategy, where the main field that we observe, this 1500 square degree field, is actually contaminated by side lobes from the sun during the summer, or during part of the summer, not the entire summer. So we can really only observe that for about 9 months a year. So there's a concept that was demonstrated with SPT POL, the previous experiment on the South Pole Telescope, that tried observing a larger patch over the summer that was in regions of the sky where observing conditions aren't as good. So it is shown in the dark blue dashed figure here. So this is lower elevation, so we're looking through more atmosphere. So the observing quality isn't as good, the noise is higher, but it allowed us to actually take data in the summer and discover something like 500 new clusters, new galaxy clusters. So we're doing something similar with SPT-3G, where we have this extended field off to the orange, orange here in this figure. And we just finished actually the first season of observations in March, and provisionally this data looks quite good actually. It should be fine, I think, for doing searching for galaxy clusters. And for high L cosmology, it may also be useful. So we think that depending on what noise level we're able to get over 4 years of doing this, we may be able to shrink our error bars on some of the neutrino masses and effective by something like 30 to 40% simply by having more sky coverage and therefore lower cosmic variance. So this is encouraging, and I think we'll probably continue doing this in subsequent years. Okay, so I want to just highlight briefly two upcoming science results that we'll hopefully be putting out in the next upcoming months. I can't say for sure when, but the first of these they're both involving the data we took in the 2018 season. So a little bit higher noise than what we have now, but still useful for doing science. So the first of these is measurement of E-modes, E-mode polarization. So this is what I'm showing here is a map of the Stokes Q parameter. And U, which have this characteristic pattern in them, where the Q has this sort of vertical striping pattern, the U has this sort of diagonal striping pattern, which is exactly what E-modes produce. This is indicative of E-modes by definition, essentially. And you can see that if you, in a very preliminary power spectrum, we're recovering reasonably well the E-mode power spectrum. So this is this work that's led by Daniel Dusher, his grad student in Chicago. And this is actually a fairly early power spectrum. He has better versions now. So don't read into the slight discrepancies with the Planck best fit, because this doesn't have a number of critical corrections in it, but it should give you a sense of the approximate signal to noise. And we expect this to be the most sensitive measurement in the E-mode power spectrum over this multipole range of about 700 to 1700.
So what's the largest contribution to the error bars there?
So this is a mix of cosmic variance and instrumental noise.
Okay.
Yeah.
But at high L, I guess it's mostly instrumental noise?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay.
Okay. So, and then this is just a forecast of after 5 years, what the constraints on the power spectrum will be. So you can see we're tending to do, I like this panel at the bottom, which shows the ratio of the error bars on the power spectrum now versus 3G, which shows basically how much we're improving as a function of multipole. And the majority of that improvement is happening at very large scales, very small scales, large multipoles, because we have this really excellent angular resolution. Okay, so the other analysis that I just want to preview is a lensing convergence map, so CMB lensing map from the 2018 data, which is a result being led by this grad student, Jody Pan, at University of Chicago. And so what this is showing is a lensing map from this minimum variance combination of TE and B maps, which is basically showing you the integrated gravitational lensing potential between us and the surface of last scattering. And so this is a preliminary map just from one frequency, but we have three frequencies that we can cross-correlate against each other. And you can compare this as well to the similar analysis that was done with SPT pole data on a smaller area of the sky. And if you flip back and forth between them, you see nicely that the light and dark spots track each other as you would expect. You also see the noise a little bit higher actually in the 3G data. And that's coming from the fact that, well, we're observing a little bit larger area of the sky, but we also have, this is our first year of data, so the noise level is significantly higher than it is in SPT pole data. And with the data we have now in the can, we're actually have lower noise levels than SPT pole over this much larger patch of the sky. So this will only continue to get better. And the reason I highlight this is because of a synergy that we have with the BICEP-Keck series of experiments. So I'm guessing many of you are familiar with or have at least heard of these projects. So these are small, low-resolution refracting telescopes. They're kind of like the microwave version of Galileo's telescope. They don't have very good angular resolution, but they're cheap and they're easy to build. And so they have built a long series of these telescopes now working on deploying the BICEP array and targeting these inflationary B modes. And you know, the reason why there's this synergy, of course, is that the lensing, gravitational lensing, acts as contaminant for the inflationary B modes. So by combining the SPT3G data with the BICEP array data, we'll actually jointly be able to have significantly improved constraints on tensor to scalar ratio R. So I think the most interesting plot that shows this is the figure on the right here, which is showing the sensitivity, sigma R, of BICEP array without delensing as a function of time. And you can see that basically without delensing, they become limited and they cannot improve in sensitivity to sigma R, and it requires having a dedicated high resolution delensing survey to remove the contamination and improve constraints on sigma R. So this is a big focus of work going forward. And we've formed this kind of joint umbrella organization between BICEP-Keck and SPT called South Pole Observatory to facilitate this work, as well as more general coordination of experimental efforts at the South Pole. Just to put this context, because I know that for people who are not experts in this field, there are a lot of names, a lot of acronyms, and it can be sometimes difficult to keep them straight, and in particular, how things are phased. This is the kind of global overview of how these projects will proceed in time. So stage two are experiments with thousands, quote, thousands of detectors. So there are projects like SPT Pole, BICEP 3, Keck Array. At the South Pole, we now have SPT 3G. BICEP Array just deployed their first of four cameras. So that will continue deploying in future years and take data through 2024 or so. We're also in the process of proposing for a new large telescope at the South Pole, which has not been funded yet, but could provide another experiment before CMB stage four, this much, much larger experiment with two sites, one in Atacama Desert in Chile, one at South Pole. And there's kind of this parallel progression going on in the Atacama Desert, where Polar Bear and Simons Array, ACT Pole, Advanced ACT have all been scaling up their telescopes in a very similar fashion and have joined forces, kind of similar to South Pole Observatory, with this very impressive experiment called Simons Observatory, which will have large telescopes, small telescopes, and kind of will act like a prototype in some ways for CMB stage four, which is what we're all ultimately working on. I'm actually spending a lot of my time, for better or worse, working on this now, which is a concept of having, instead of one telescope or a small number of telescopes, we'll have three large 6-meter telescopes one at South Pole, two in the Atacama, something like 18 of these small refractor telescopes, low resolution telescopes focused on doing the inflation survey. And the large telescopes will be dedicated to a wide area survey focusing on neutrinos, cross correlations, and all these will have many frequency bands to mitigate foregrounds and so on. So the large telescopes will actually look a lot like what's shown here is the Simons Observatory Large Telescope. And this is this cryostat design, this crazy, crazy cryostat design we've been working on at Fermilab that has like 85 of these optics tubes and is like 2.5 meters in diameter. It's a scary thing. And the small aperture telescopes will look a lot like what Bicep Array is deploying. And you know, this is the obligatory advertisement slide. You can do a lot of science with CMBS4. It's great. So I'm gonna shift gears a little bit now and talk about something a little bit stranger, but this Axion idea that we've been starting to work on with SPT3G data since the pandemic started and we got locked out of the lab. So the point of this slide is just to remind you, although I think you guys know much better than me probably that axions can arise in a variety of models and can be a viable dark matter candidate across a range of masses. So the masses that we're considering here are roughly in the neighborhood of something like 10 to the minus 19 to 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. So these are ultralight axions that you can imagine, or people often talk about potentially alleviating some of these small scale issues with lambda CDM. So the main way in which these axions have typically been probed is through this birefringence effect that comes from the fact that the axion photon coupling modifies Maxwell's equations so that the fields that satisfy the free wave equation are no longer the E and B fields, but the displacement field. And so when you have a change in the axion field, it will produce a rotation of the plane of polarization that depends on the value of the axion field. And in particular, the rotation of the polarization angle depends on the difference between the value of the axion field when the photon was emitted versus when it's absorbed and detected. Okay, so that's what this figure off to the right is trying to convey, is you can have these arbitrarily complicated axion field configurations, but as long as the only thing that matters is the value of the axion field at absorption and emission. And so this is the basis, this idea of birefringence is the basis for many searches for axions, of course, not just using the CMB, using radio sources. It's also the basis for searching for this category, this class of analyses that are pretty standard now in CMB, searches for anisotropic polarization rotation, where you look for like different rotation angles on different parts of the sky. So Polar Bear has done this, ActPol has done this, and actually just today there was a paper from SPTPOL that came out that does this. So this is kind of that class of studies is an industry now. But there's a second effect, which is pointed out recently, that has not been used, at least in the context of CMB, to search for axions, which is pointed out in this paper last year by Michael Federke, who's on the line. And the idea here is that you can, for a particular range of axion masses, the local oscillation of the axion field at the Earth should induce time dependence in the polarization rotation angle, which is comparable to the time scale, the operating time scale of actual experiments, something like days to years. And you could actually go out and search for this time dependent polarization rotation. Okay, so there's this additional wrinkle that happens, of course, that because you know the birefringence angle or rotation depends not only on the value of the axion field today, it also depends on the value of the axion field when the photons were emitted. And when we look at the CMB, we're looking at photons that came from a range of different of positions in the visibility function of the CMB. So the right way to think about this is this with this diagram that's I'm showing on the right here, where the black line is indicating the rotation at different slices of the surface of last scattering. So as you go throughout the surface of last scattering, the photons from the different slices basically create this fan of different polarization rotations that as long as the axion field undergoes many oscillations in the course of the visibility function. And so what you see then is kind of the difference between that average value and the rotation that's induced by the local oscillation of the axion field today. And so what that means is that since we're seeing the effect of the local variation, the local oscillation of the axion field, that it's coherent across the sky and it's common to all observers. So different experiments should basically see the same thing. More formally, you can divide this into two qualitatively different effects, looking at how the Q and U Stokes parameters rotate into each other. The first of these is this polarization washout effect. So the idea here is that the fact that you are averaging over the surface of last scattering means that you end up suppressing slightly the overall amplitude of polarization, which means you're suppressing the E-mode polarization, basically. So that means the TT power spectrum will be unchanged, TE will be suppressed by one factor, and the EE power spectrum will be suppressed by two factors. And you can use this as the basis for setting limits on the axion photon coupling. And another nice aspect of this is that this effect is not easily mimicked by adjusting the six base parameters in lambda CDM. So that was something that this paper explored. But one thing that's not necessarily ideal about it is that it's degenerate with the polarization calibration or efficiency. And it turns out that polarization calibration experimentally is actually very hard to do. It's really hard to do much better than a group degree. So that's kind of a limit with this washout effect. The second qualitatively different effect is coming from the time dependence. So this looks like a mixing of the Q and U Stokes parameters into each other, the global time varying global polarization rotation. Or equivalently, a mixing of E and B modes, where the amplitude is set by the axion photon coupling, frequency is set by the axion mass, and the phase is arbitrary. But again, this is coherent over the full sky and should be seen with it by the same phase, even though the phase is arbitrary, should be seen by with the same phase by all observers. So this paper used the washout effect from in Planck data to set a limit on axion photon coupling in this mass range of 10 to the 20 minus 20-ish eV. But couldn't actually set a limit using this AC modulation effect for the simple reason that CMB experiments don't release their time-dependent data. We never analyze data. I can only think of one example where we've actually analyzed CMB data in the time domain, and that was for looking for astrophysical transients. And certainly those data, time-dependent data, were not published. So this is something that CMB experimental collaborations have to do. But it's a nice effect to look for because for a few reasons. One is it doesn't suffer from the cosmic variance limit because you can just keep integrating for longer and seeing more oscillations. So you're not limited by cosmic variance in the same way you are when you're measuring static power spectrum. I would say from an experimentalist point of view, it's relatively immune to systematics. There aren't a lot of experimental systematics that give you oscillations in polarization rotation angle, except for at a few very specific and suspicious frequencies or periods, like 1 year or 1 day associated with rotation of the telescope. And even then, it's a little bit tricky to think about how that could produce a rotation, a birefringent effect that would be time dependent. So it's I would say, a very robust observable. And it has this nice ability that you can use it, you can cross-check the frequency and phase across multiple experiments. So we're in the process of working on this now, and SPT is kind of nice, and our typical data reduction pipeline is actually quite nice for doing this because of the way that our observing cadence works. So we observe, like I said, this 1500 square degree field, which is split into these four subfields that we revisit every couple of hours in this observing cadence that is shown on the bottom here. So there's some dead time associated with dealing with the cryogenics, but then every 3 hours or so, we spend about 2.5 hours observing one of these different subfields, and we do it repeatedly. We do this 20-hour cycle continuously. So in principle, we actually should be sensitive to periods that are less than a day because of this rapid revisiting of the same patches of the sky. The other thing that's nice about SPT is the advantage that the small beam affords for this analysis. So what I'm showing on the left here is just the power spectrum in blue, the E-mode power spectrum, and orange, the SPT, the power spectrum seen by SPT after correcting for the beam, whereas green is the what Bicep and Keck sees. So the Bicep Keck beam is something like, at least at 150 gigahertz, is something like a factor of 30 larger, which means they're really missing most of the E-mode power spectrum. And so if you push that through to what is the sensitivity to a polarization rotation from E-modes that an equivalently sensitive detector would see in SPT versus in Bicep Keck, that's what's shown in the right-hand figure. And it turns out that the SPT detector is about a factor of 4 times more sensitive to a polarization rotation. So you might naively think that Bicep Keck have all these telescopes, very deep maps, but actually this beam effect ends up being quite significant in terms of the overall sensitivity of the experiment. And Ari, who is a collaborator of ours working on Bicep, and us, I think aren't quite sure actually which experiment should be better. I think it's a little bit of it's a little bit uncertain currently. So they're comparable probably in terms of the overall sensitivity to this effect. So the basic flow of the analysis then is pretty straightforward. So we have already these single observation maps, which look like these slices in Q and U on the sky. We can use them to estimate the global polarization rotation angle for each individual observation. Then we just combine these in a time series and fit them to sinusoids to set limits. And then there's this whole rather difficult question of how to deal with null tests for systematics that we're still trying to figure out. But this is the basic flow is quite straightforward, I think. We're also, I think we're doing this analysis in quite possibly the simplest, dumbest way possible because we can. So we're using a real space estimator, which basically is just a matched filter on the Q and it's a matched filter on the polarization rotation. So we have these individual observation maps, but we also have a really good estimate of what the CMB looks like because we can add them all up and construct a coad that on average will have the rotation averaged away. And then we just do a matched filter using these co-added Q and U templates to extract this polarization, global polarization rotation angle for each individual observation. And because the maps are noise dominated and dominated in particular by atmospheric noise, in particular by instrumental noise in Q and U, it's actually reasonable to approximate the covariance as diagonal. So all of this becomes fairly straightforward, at least we think. And so just to give a rough projection of the sensitivity, this is what we think SPT-3G 2019 data should be able to do. So we think we'll actually be able to do a little bit better than the Planck washout. And full survey forecast will probably be something like a factor of square root of 5 better. And then if you were to project this forward into CMBS4, which involves some wild guesses, you would end up with something like this. So in principle, I think it's realistic to maybe do about an order of magnitude, or a little bit better than an order of magnitude, better than the Planck washout limit using this technique. So that's interesting. And I think it's also just a good test case for analyzing CMB data in the time domain, which is something that's not done very often, but has a lot of power, especially for looking for astrophysical transients that it might emit in the millimeter. So a different, totally different physics, but the similar kind of structure of the data analysis. And lastly, just to highlight your...
Sorry, yeah. What is the limiting, the masses on the left and right here?
Oh, what are these other...
Your line has a cutoff at around 10 to... a couple of times 10 to the minus 22, and the other side is 10 to minus 19, right? What's that range?
So that is set by the duration. So it's set by two things. So on the large period, low mass side, it's set by the total duration we're looking at. So I cut this off at about 100 days. That's because the at least in 2019, the observing season is something 250 days. So you want to have more than one cycle. For the full survey, actually, since it will be 5 years, this could go down by probably another factor of five, and that would be fine. I didn't draw it that way because I had laziness. And then on the short side, we truncated this at 1 day. And that has to do with some, so I think we could go a little bit lower because we observe every 3 hours. But we set it at 1 day because the way that we don't observe the same field every 3 hours. We have these four different fields. And so there's this kind of pattern between them that has a period of about a day. So that's why we chopped it off there. We could probably go again, maybe a factor of two or three lower. But then you can imagine there being weird effects that happen when the oscillation period becomes comparable to basically the sampling frequency of your observations. So I think this was a very conservative choice, but you probably can't do more than an order of magnitude better on either end.
That's it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So this slide is just to highlight that we're working with a Bicep Keck collaboration, and Ari in particular, to hopefully at some point in the little bit longer term, combine these two data sets and improve our joint results. So I'm out of time, I think, and I thought maybe I'd just take some questions here, if there are any.
That's first time to speak. Questions?
Well, maybe if I can, I was curious to ask some more general questions about these classes of detectors. So it's like 33, you had a comparison, a rough scheme of the timeline for the experiments, both at Atacama and South Pole. And I was curious to ask you something more in general about what are the differences between these classes of experiments, what is better and what is worse in both cases.
Yeah, so you're wondering about the difference between the experiments in Atacama versus South Pole?
Yeah, I expect that detector should be quite similar, or particular different choices.
Yeah, so the main difference actually is sky coverage. So the Atacama Desert's close to the equator, so in principle they can see much more of the sky. And that is actually very beneficial if you're trying to measure cosmological parameters, basically because you can reduce cosmic variance. So you can get more, detect more galaxy clusters in principle by having more sky coverage. So it's better for that. Turns out it's worse for doing a search for doing the B mode search. So for B modes, you're not actually detecting any CMB power yet. So you actually have more sensitivity by going deep on a small patch of the sky. And in the Atacama, because the sky is actually rising and setting, you lose some efficiency. You can't focus on the same patch of the sky 24 hours a day. And so that means if you look at the forecasts for SOB mode constraints, they're like comparable or even possibly not quite as good as the bicep array constraints. I probably should check that before I make that claim. But it has to do with the fact that the South Pole, because of being able to observe the same patch of the sky year round, really does give you a little bit better sensitivity. And in terms of observing conditions, it's also kind of a trade-off. So Atacama is higher, which means that you're looking through less atmosphere, which means that at low frequencies, low CMB frequencies, observing conditions actually are a little bit better. But at higher frequencies where you're more limited by water, the South Pole atmosphere is a lot more stable. And so in general, the South Pole is a little bit better for high frequencies most of the year. But then it's a little bit more complicated because the best conditions in the Atacama are better than the conditions at the South Pole, but on average, things are worse. So in the end, maybe it's kind of a wash. But I would say the key difference is large area surveys are really where the Chilean experiments shine, and inflation surveys are really where the South Pole is a little bit better.
Okay, thanks.
More questions?
Hey Adam, yeah, I wanted to ask about, so you mentioned the lensing maps that you can get from SPT Pole, right? Are those things that you can compare with Planck?
Yeah.
And I mean, just because, I guess not quite the lensing maps, but Planck has this funny issue where they have this A lens parameter, which seems to be deviating from their expectation. I don't know if there's something similar that more high L experiments can say about this kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I am familiar with that issue. I'm trying to remember the details, but I maybe you remember better than me. So there was an internal tension, right, in A lens between the large scales and small scales in Planck data, if I'm remembering.
Yeah. And I think they have some cross-check for their lensing maps, and I think the lensing maps seem okay, but then I think some effect that's characterized by this A lens on the power spectrum, which I think is some phenomenological effect. They need to tune it to higher values than they expected.
Yeah. So there's a paper actually, an SPT Pole paper that I should be remembering better than I am now that does look into this effect. And if I remember correctly, I think they see a similar effect, but I'd have to go check that paper.
Okay.
So, but yes, it is something that the SPT Pole and 3G eventually. Data sets will be able to cross check.
Great, thanks.
More questions before we stop recording?
Well, so you also mentioned S4, I guess, which is coming. So what's the status of that, actually?
Say that again.
Is it funded or not?
Yeah. So this is not very interesting, but unfortunately, I am subject to these things. So the DOE has this series of critical. The Department of Energy in the U.S. has this series of critical decisions, which. And so if you're at CD0, that basically means the project exists and it's going to happen. And then you progress through this. And so right now CMB S4 is at CD zero, which means that it will happen. Not all of the funding has been secured or released for the project, but it's gonna happen, and it will eventually be funded. So right now we have a little bit of money to do our early R&D. So we're building like the first detectors. So not like a full S4 prototype, but kind of initial version of the detectors and at Fermilab, we're actually building initial versions of the modules that will go into the, be able to test the detectors that will ultimately go into the telescope. But the production, the mass production of all this stuff probably won't start until 2022, 2023. And then we'll actually be deploying telescopes sometime starting around 2026. So even in the nominal baseline, it's still quite a few years off.
But it's purely DOE projects, like NSF is not involved?
So if I, my understanding, which is a little bit above my pay grade, but my understanding of the way this works is that NSF will fund the telescopes and the DOE will fund the detectors and the readout. So the telescopes, the large telescopes are not a huge part of the project in terms of cost, but they're obviously critical, and there are some political issues related to which agency is allowed to build things called a telescope.
But on the R&D side, like, is it like the most of the things, like building more and more of these chips, or like you're also improving like these chips?
Yeah, so on the R&D side, we basically know how we're going to build the detectors and the readout at kind of the qualitative level. Really what we're doing is we're taking existing technologies, picking among them, and then kind of doing a reoptimization for S4. So the whole point of S4 is actually that it should involve as little new technology as possible. But it doesn't mean that, you know, there's no work involved in designing, unfortunately, the thing we actually build. We can't just like directly copy what other experiments have done, although we are trying to do so as much as possible.
Nice. Cool. Okay. I guess we can thank the speaker again, then we can continue chatting privately.
Yeah.